recording audio, digital, and video as well.
All right. And should I look at the camera or look at you?
Best to just look at me.
Okay, good.
Hopefully this will go, I mean, it doesn't entirely go away, but
okay.
we can pretend that it does, and just have a conversation.
Good.
And I do this fairly informal style, but I always like to talk, start with people's family background and get a sense of what sort of informed them as they took on these paths later in life. So that's usually where I start, and then we can move quickly forward from there.
Good.
But for the record, I'll just say that it's April the 17th, 2010, in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I'm David Klein for the Southern Oral History Program, and I'm sitting here today with Taylor Branch. Thank you very much
Thank you, David.
Your time today. As I just said, if we could start some facts, if you could just tell me about where and when you were born, and we'll start with there, and then we'll get into a conversation about the movement and your work in recording it.
Good, I'm happy to. And it's kind of, usually I'm where you are.
Right.
Doing oral history, so.
And I'd much rather be over here, having sometimes been over there, so.
Well, I was born in January 14th, 47, mm-hmm. I'm 63, mm-hmm. In Atlanta. So I grew up in Atlanta, Dr. King's hometown. Before the movement started, I was 7 years old the year of the Brown decision. I don't remember that. I wasn't paying any attention to it. My dad had one very small dry cleaner that I started working in when I was five. And I don't want to overemphasize it, but we were a pretty struggling family then. By the time I finished college, he had 10 or 12 dry cleaning plants and was doing fairly well, but we had six children. So my childhood, my dad was working hard building businesses, we were not political, didn't care about politics. I do remember that the early civil rights movement, when the sit-in started, I was just starting high school, and that it was scary to everybody. But I avoided it like everybody else. Later on, I found out most black people avoided it too. It was a pretty scary thing.
So you were in high school at that time,
1960? I was 13.
Okay.
I was just starting.
Right.
I was 14 during the Freedom Rides. I don't think I paid them very much attention. I was planning to, I had a terrible motorcycle accident when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
Almost got killed. Believed, probably accurately, that this orthopedic surgeon saved my life, and therefore I decided to become an orthopedic surgeon. That's all I was thinking about. But meanwhile, the movement kept going. I mean, it just kept going, and it was all around me. And it began to eat on my mind I got an athletic scholarship before my motorcycle accident to go to a very prominent private school in Atlanta and play baseball for them. They won't say it's an athletic scholarship, but they came and recruited me off of a playing field. So I'm there at this at Westminster, a wonderful, wonderful school, but kind of there weren't any other dry cleaning kids there.
Mm-hmm.
It was I'm there at this school, and
were there any black kids there?
Absolutely none. Okay. There were none, and the only place that I knew and interacted with black people was in my dad's cleaners. Because
mm-hmm.
virtually all of his employees were black. And I knew all of them well because I'd known them since I started working there, since I was a little kid. I mean, my first job was putting trouser guards on boxes of hangers by the 500.
Mm-hmm.
And they would supervise me. And I did, by the time I left, I did everything. I ironed, I put things in the laundry, I waited on the front and learned how to handle customers and everything, but always under the supervision, if not my dad, of his employees. But at the school and everywhere else, absolutely no black students anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The public schools were segregated. The cultures were totally segregated. And yet, what began to prey on me was that the very prominent people in Atlanta had their children at this school, and it was important for them to say that the school was not segregated, even though it had no black students. And I don't know how much you know about prep school culture, but it really picks up on hypocrisy pretty fast. Mm-hmm. And so there was a constant undercurrent of humor, not progressive humor, because a lot of it was just that they were hypocrites, but that there wasn't any admiration for the movement either. Weird things started undercutting my political apathy is not the right word. I was anti-political. To me, it was kind of threatening. But believe it or not, it was rock and roll crossover music that was one of the first things that got me to actually think about it, because I sang in the Atlanta Boy Choir, and I was kind of snooty about rock and roll music until one day somebody who was driving me to school, another student, because I was too young to drive, said, "How come you say snide things about rock and roll music, but because you're singing classical music, and
right,
but you know the words of every rock and roll song that comes on the radio?" And it was true. I had to admit it. I knew the word. This was the golden era of crossover. This was Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke and Jerry Butler and the Drifters, and these were amazing. The early Shirelles, and it was wonderful music. Arthur Alexander. Some of these names may not mean very much.
How were you hearing this on?
On the radio.
On white radio stations.
Oh, yeah.
Or were you listening to black radio stations?
I was listening to white radio stations, I'm pretty sure. Right. But it's also true, one of the first things that struck me was that some of my friends who were hostile to black people, I was always taught to be very polite and never to use derogatory words, and the only black people you know are your friends, and they hug you and take care of you, and this is a dangerous subject, don't get involved in politics, but be polite. Well, I knew some kids that were hostile, that would use epithets about black people, but it stunned me that some of those same ones would sneak out and go down to hear Ray Charles, who was from that area, and he would play at Herndon Stadium. And it occurred to me that that the involvement with this music was pretty deep. People wouldn't court their girlfriends to any music but this. And there was a very powerful emotional bond to this music that the way I later described it was that because we were always full of self-deprecating humor, that we white kids there at Westminster were destined to grow up and run the world and wear neckties and use big words and everything, but we believed that black people, while we're all stiff and formal, that they have the keys to the human heart. And your girlfriend, if you really want your girlfriend where you're going to make an emotional connection, you've got to go through black music. And Johnny Mathis was about as white as you could get. He was a famous romantic black singer then. But and about that time, our high school had Bo Diddley come play at Westminster. And Bo Diddley came and played his music, and it got back to one of the parents, and it caused a big storm because it was considered to be too sexual. He was one of the early rock and roll icons. Another one was Hank Ballard, of Hank Ballard and the Midnight. We would sneak out and go down and hear Hank Ballard.
Right. But Bo Diddley's race wasn't the concern, it was the lyrics.
Well, no.
Or it was both.
They were conjoined in the mind. There was a huge panic in the administration of this prep school that because Bo Diddley had sung and had sung about what they saw as flamboyantly sexual lyrics, that they would henceforth ban black groups.
Oh, wow.
So that connected, but that it wasn't because of race, it was just to guarantee that this sort of sexual thing wouldn't come. So anyway.
But implicit in that is that.
It was just.
You can't separate this sex from black folks.
So I kept thinking about it. But meanwhile, the movement keeps going. And I'm saying, here I am in a world where I hug and know Annie Pearl Ivory and Willie Lee Harris and my cleaner, Peter Mitchell. I know all these people, but I've never been in their homes. It's kind of intimate and separate. And then there's this music. We're in an all-white school, but we're devoted to this music, and I don't really know where that comes from. And meanwhile, all this stuff is bubbling up. It's all around us, but everybody is nervous if you talk about it at all, honestly. That it really started eating away at me. Why? How can I be growing up in this culture with all this stuff going on, and I don't know anything about it? And my dad's cleaner, Peter Mitchell, they both had these extraordinary senses of humor. He's the guy that put the dry cleaning fluid into the wheel and spotted things. And Dad worked alongside, he was a boss but an owner, but they worked together because it was the most, it's getting the clothes dirty. They had very, very compatible senses of humor. They both knew how to tell jokes. There are not that many people in the world who know how to. They remembered every joke they'd ever heard. My dad's dealing with the public, and somehow he would make connections with his customers and the people at the bank. He knew all the joke circulators, and he would circulate, and Peter would circulate jokes that he knew. He was like that from the black community, so they would circulate all these jokes. And then we would go to the baseball games together, the three of us, several times. Our team was the Atlanta Crackers, believe it or not, in the Southern Association. This is the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And we would go to the games together, and they would be joking all the way down there, telling jokes. And then when we get to the ballpark, it would kind of die out because we had to separate. Peter had to go sit in the colored section. The only racial comment I can ever remember, other than be polite, from my dad was a couple of times he would say he didn't like this, going to the games, when I was 7 or 8 years old. And I didn't take it as a political comment that he wanted to do something about it or anything, because I really knew that he considered segregation, you know, like the weather, you know, right. You're not going to do anything about it. That's idle and foolish and dangerous. But I just took it to mean that he wished that he could go on down to the game and keep joking with Peter, and that he didn't like it. Mm-hmm. But I also knew that the subject was so radioactive that I wasn't supposed to make any further comment or say why or what does that mean. When he just said, "I don't like this," it was a really pregnant thing. It was like a really intimate revel. It was like a father-son talk. Mm-hmm. You know? So these things started preying on me a lot, that here was this subject that was so fraught and yet so full of hypocrisy and fear, and yet it went very deep. It went deep in music and emotion, and black people were saying that it was a betrayal of democracy, and we're supposed to take democracy seriously, and they're singing church songs, and I'm singing the same church songs, but we're totally separate. So it started preying on me, and by the time I was a junior in high school, when the Birmingham riots, Birmingham demonstrations broke out, and they had a big effect on me. I've often said that I think that they were similar. Most of the black students that I later interviewed, I mean the civil rights leaders, call the Emmett Till murder, because they're older than I am. Emmett Till was murdered in 55 when I was, I don't remember that, but that was a galvanizing moment for the entire civil rights generation, that somebody their age, on and on, all these people. For me, it was the Birmingham demonstrations in 63, 8 years later. I'm in high school. I'm growing up. I'm starting to think about all these things. Political, but I'm bugged. It's under my skin, and then I see all these. And in fact, I kind of just decided that when I got really old and secure as an orthopedic surgeon, like maybe 30 years old or something, that maybe I would stick my toe in the water on this race. That this race thing really was, it seemed important about it. And I didn't know what to do, but I was scared about it.
But that was a you remember having that?
I remember having that consciousness, and then being ambushed by these photographs of the dogs and the fire hoses on these kids in Birmingham. And they were younger than I was. They were half my age. Some of them were really small, and they were mostly girls. And And they weren't waiting until they were 30, and mm-hmm. They were doing things that just seemed, they were marching in and keeping going. And I don't know whether it was the cruelty of it, how can this be happening, or the courage, where does this come from? But I was just stunned by that. And mm-hmm. And I asked my mom and dad where it came from and how it could be happening, and they didn't have any answers, and nobody did. And it really started bugging me, and of course it just continued. And I finished high school the next year, the year of freedom, right before Freedom Summer, mm-hmm. and with the Civil Rights Bill being filibustered, I finished high school. And by the time I got off to college, I started losing interest in my pre-med courses and soon dropped them and mm-hmm. started really. But I knew I didn't grow up with any kind of political sophistication. I didn't debate it. I didn't read about it. So when I got to college, I started taking political philosophy courses and mm-hmm. history courses and politics courses and everything to try to catch up with.
Where was college?
College was University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Oh, right.
So I went there on an academic scholarship. I thought I was going to have to play football, but I had terrible shoulders and I had my hip all messed up from my automobile accident. But at that time, we had more children than dry cleaning plants, and my family needed me to get a scholarship. And at the last minute, I got an academic scholarship, a Moorhead scholarship to Chapel Hill. And they asked me if I needed to think it over, because I was about to sign a football scholarship. Do you want to give up your athletic career? And I said, I don't need to think it over more than 10 seconds. If I don't have to play football, I'd love to go to Chapel Hill sight unseen. So I came here and got involved in but of course, you know, Selma was my freshman year, mm-hmm. but Vietnam was also starting. So mm-hmm. when I was starting college right at the height of all the upheaval when civil rights and the Vietnam War were all intermingled, mm-hmm. I think my first original political thought, such as it was, that I can remember telling people, a few years later, was that the anti-war movement that I was seeing, I was going to meetings and debates and even demonstrations on the war as a college student, was a largely campus-based, largely white mm-hmm. movement that seemed to me to be copying the black civil rights movement. As little as I knew about it, it seemed to me that we were taking our distant impression of it, first of all, that young people mm-hmm. could be significant actors.
Right.
Second of all, that you know, you could study things and then and demonstrate. And I thought that we had a very superficial notion of the civil rights movement, even though I didn't know how complex it was. I thought we were, and again, I used a musical image. I thought we were covering the civil rights movement the same way Ricky Nelson used to cover Little Richard songs. That we were just almost aping it. You know. We can be important too, and these are big matters, and so on and so forth. But you know, the civil rights movement was just kind of getting carried away with turn the other cheek and boycotting. Vietnam is international affairs and really complicated for white people who wear neckties, and that we should work on that. And I told people that I thought that there was something wrong about that. That to me, I knew that the civil rights movement had changed my life's interest against my will. I hadn't been looking for it to happen. I hadn't even been weighing it as an option. It just forced itself in. And it was because of a tremendous emotional power that I didn't understand, but I knew had to be based on something a lot deeper than just this superficial notion that those black kids, you know, they ran out there and demonstrated and raised hell if they didn't get a satisfactory answer.
Right.
So anyway, by the time I finished college in 68, that was the great, Dr. King was killed in the spring of my senior year in college. I was political by then. The only real big thing I did at Carolina was I was chairman of the Carolina Symposium, mm-hmm. Which they held every 2 years. And when I was named chairman as a sophomore at the end of 66, the public explanation for the Vietnam War was that it was to contain China, because China was supporting it. And so we decided that we didn't know anything about China and to have a symposium on China and the West. in the spring of 68. And so that's what we were doing, and Jesse Helms, who had a TV show, attacked it, said, we already know everything we need to know about China. It was communist. He attacked me personally a whole bunch right when it happened. So we brought all these China scholars. It started on Monday, on Sunday night, the 31st. I'd been working on it for 2 years. The 31st of March.
1968.
68, which I didn't know this, but it was the day Dr. King gave his last sermon at the Washington Cathedral before going back to Memphis. And we opened the symposium with Edgar Snow, a renowned China scholar who had been driven out of the United States in the McCarthy era, and we brought him back from Geneva. It's the first time he'd been back.
Yeah.
He gave this lecture in the afternoon, and then we took him to the Carolina Inn, and my mother came up from Atlanta to be here for the week of the symposium. So my mother and I took Edgar Snow into his hotel room and watched Lyndon Johnson give his speech that night, because he gave a speech right after Edgar Snow's speech, and it was the one when he shocked everybody saying he wasn't going to run again because of Vietnam. And so everything was kind of supercharged, and we had the symposium Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. It finished Thursday, and my mom was going to fly out Friday morning, and I took her to dinner on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. And in the middle of dinner, this hush went through the restaurant, and people came in saying Martin Luther King had been shot in Memphis. So this is, my formative years are marked by all of these things. And over that summer, I was very involved in anti-war protests. I worked in some of the presidential, I would get sent in to primary states where Johnson, or Humphrey, who came in to run in Johnson's stead, where Gene McCarthy was contesting him. And I worked in a bunch of these things. Bobby Kennedy was killed.
So you got very involved, despite that, the feeling that you described before about the sort of aping characteristic of the anti-war.
Oh, I just thought that this was a danger. You know, I didn't know what to do about it. I thought the war, it was important to stop the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was a danger, and I still think that it was a danger, that we that the white movement kind of ran amok. And in part, it was because it didn't appreciate the discipline and the depth of thought that kept the early civil rights movement going. But nevertheless, no, I was working as a volunteer in presidential campaigns as a 21-year-old.
Right.
And when I came down to Georgia, my home state of Georgia, there was a movement to challenge Lester Maddox. Who was our governor, and a notorious segregationist. And in those days, the governor appointed all the delegates, and he appointed virtually all white delegates. In fact, I think it was virtually all white men. And so it was vulnerable to challenge on a lot of grounds, and a lot of people, labor unions and other people. So I got involved with a challenge that was modeled, as a 21-year-old, modeled on the Mississippi Freedom Democrats of 64. Right down to the notion that if we do this challenge this year, maybe it'll bear fruit 4 years from now, that, you know, you don't really expect to get seated the first time. So we were going to do this, but what you had to do was to have a more open democratic process, choose a delegation, and go and contest it at the convention. And so there were all these people doing it, a lot of people running around and different, and I was assigned the task of going to black churches to recruit people to come to a convention to choose a challenge delegation. And that was an eye-opening experience to me. I went down and did all that just to recruit them. And we had this convention in Macon. And the other thing they asked me to do, these are labor leaders and people running the presidential campaign. By then, George McGovern's campaign was in on it, McCarthy's and others. And we'd meet downtown. And I'm just graduated from college. They didn't have a public spokesperson. And they wanted somebody to go, did anybody know Julian Bond? Because he had gotten a lot of publicity from getting excluded by the Georgia legislature. And that since we were challenging that same Georgia political structure, he would have been a perfect spokesperson. And so I went and pitched Julian Bond to become the chair. I'm 21 and he's, what, 28 or something. That summer. And
did you know him, or did
no?
I
never
know
him.
Call?
It was a cold call, and he met with me and talked it over and was reluctant to do it, weighing whether it was whether it was going to succeed or fail, whether it was going to be good or bad, whether it was going to be racially progressive, whether it was a vehicle just for somebody's presidential ambitions. Mm-hmm. Our delegation ultimately had people who supported all the different presidents. Because basically, if you were for McCarthy or McGovern or whoever you were for, any kind of delegation that you put together was going to get more votes for your candidate than Maddox's delegation. Mm-hmm. So it made sense from everybody's point of view. But anyway, John Lewis, that's when I met John Lewis and a bunch of other people. And then, believe it or not, that summer, I went up as gopher, literally gopher. I ironed Julian's shirts. That's all. I always tease him. We've been friends ever since. We discovered that summer that we had the same birthday, and we've celebrated it ever since. But then we didn't know that. We were just in this chaotic 1968 adventure, and we went to Chicago together, and we didn't think we were going to get seated for the credentials hearings. Only just mm-hmm. a few of us, a couple of lawyers, and Julian as the chair, and me as the gopher. Mm-hmm. We went up there and ran around, and then lo and behold, they seat us. So now we've got to bring the whole delegation up, and to a city where every hotel room has been taken for 6 months, and most of the delegates were poor, and we didn't have any money, had no airfare.
Right.
So Julian says to me, you know, bring the delegation up. So anyway, that was a big adventure.
You're already there. So you have
I'm
to
already
go
there.
Back.
Well, yeah, we had to, I had to go back, but first we had to raise the money.
Right.
Julian wound up going to see Elijah Muhammad, and I went around. I got the hotel room through one of Elijah Muhammad's people. So there are a lot of adventures in an ultimately tragic political year.
Mm-hmm.
Lost the election to Nixon, and both King and Bobby Kennedy were killed, and lots of things happened.
Did you actually go back and get delegates? And
yeah, we brought them up.
Brought them up.
Brought them up.
Drove them up or flew
no,
them
no,
up?
No, they flew up,
yeah.
And then of course. We were in the hall most of the time, but that was the convention where there was tear gas. A lot of our guys got hurt.
Right.
But we were in the hall most of the time. We didn't get hurt like the people who were out in the street demonstrating, but it was a chaotic, violent convention, and we loved. I went to graduate school, and the next summer, I worked for the Voter Education Project, this time explicitly. I was a graduate student at Princeton. They wanted me to work for the World Bank or some policy relevant thing. It was very
right.
high toned. I wanted to work for VEP, even though because I that 68 experience in the convention convinced me, alongside knowing already that I was consumed with all this political stuff because of the civil rights movement. Then I've had these experiences. I missed being part of the either too young or too behind, politically immature,
mm-hmm.
to be part of the civil rights movement. And it was disintegrating at that time by the summer of 69. And I wanted to do something, have some
mm-hmm.
experience, even if it was a solo experience. And Vernon Jordan hired me to, they had 20 counties in Georgia where they didn't even have anybody on the Rolodex as a possible voter registration worker. Which was a revelation to me, and you know, I thought they were everywhere.
Right.
There were a lot of counties where they had never been, they didn't know anybody, and they asked me basically to parachute into these tiny counties in a car by myself and scout for people that might be willing and able to administer a voter registration grant in all these tiny counties that had no black registered voters to speak of.
Right.
Seminole County, not the ones where the movement had been, because they already had people there. But
what part of Georgia was?
Southwest Georgia.
In Southwest Georgia.
In right. Southwest Georgia. All the way from, I think, Donaldsonville in Seminole County was the very tip one there, and along the Florida border and up as far as Randolph County, where Cuthbert is,
mm-hmm.
And over Lee County, Schley County, lots, but really tiny ones.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where you drive in, there's the courthouse town and the Confederate statue and the automobile dealer and a couple of churches, and that's it, you know.
Right.
And
did you run into what had been the Albany movement in the Southwest?
No.
Georgia
well, I did
point?
In the sense that they told me to go see C.B. King.
Okay, right.
Go
right.
see people, and they gave me some names to go see, but basically he didn't know these people either. It was just kind of as a resource thing.
These are places they just hadn't gone
right.
to.
Well, my job, I had 20 counties to do in 60 days, so I had 3 days per county, and I was just supposed to drive in, basically, and start looking around. And that summer became, without, I don't know your time, it became a real life changer for me in two respects. First of all, it was profoundly humbling in the sense that I had no idea what I was doing, and it taught me that pretty rapidly. I mean, I started off, all I knew to do was to drive in. It was easy to find the black part of town because it was unpaved, and find a Baptist church because it had a sign on it.
Right.
But my idea was to go to the black Baptist church and knock on the door and hope that I was discovering the next Martin Luther King or something, because that was my only idea of the civil rights leader. And they all threw me out and said they had everything under control, even though there were no black registered voters, and you could see that they were scared.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the black establishment figures threw me out. And then I knew just a little enough from reading about the civil rights movement, about SNCC and the more rebellious types. But how do you find the rebellious types who might consider the established leaders Uncle Toms, and maybe they would know somebody who would be brave enough to do a voter registration project? So the only thing I knew to do there was to go into the juke joints and think, you know, maybe some of the gangster types. And that didn't work either. None of them were.
So did it have to be an organization that would administer?
No, these are people.
It could just be people.
I'm looking
that
for
were
people.
Willing to start.
My quest to find a Stokely Carmichael or a Malcolm X type in these tiny rural counties didn't
right.
work very well either.
Either.
I did get arrested in a place called Bubba Doo's Big Apple outside of Cuthbert, Georgia, when the sheriff came in to this dry county with the Miller Beer Man and to get his cut, I guess. And I was trying to play poker in the Bubba Doo's poker game, hoping that would win enough respect that they would talk about voter registration, but I was losing money and they weren't interested in voter registration. Then the sheriff comes in and arrests me, and it was both terrifying and humorous, I guess a lot like the movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I didn't know anything. But by the end of the summer, very quickly I'm getting into new counties and just walking out into cornfields, asking people in the fields, most of whom wouldn't even talk to me, some of them would run away. If there was anybody in the county who was was trying to figure out what would be a successful word for authority figure or somebody who would do this, and it was really hard for me to even make connections in that conversation. But of course, eventually they started. The only ones they would suggest were women, and I didn't even think about women. So I wound up going into women. I had all these adventures, and I still remember a lot of them to this day. And ultimately, I found three people in three counties that I recommended, and they all got voter registration grants, and they were all headed by women, which I never would have dreamed. And they all had the same profession, which I really never would have dreamed. That they were all midwives,
yeah, right.
And they had this natural authority, and they would intimidate people who were scared to meet me. I mean, people were scared to come to a meeting in a church to meet a graduate student. An unthreatening graduate student about voter registration, and it took the authority of these midwives even to get people to come to a meeting. But in the course of this experience was so overwhelming to me that I wrote a diary of it, and not just a summary diary. I tried to write it like a novel. I didn't think of it like a novel. I tried to write down the dialogue, because the language and the humor and the description was as important to me as anything. And I wrote it down, and it became a big. It was 400 pages long by the end of the summer, and I turned it in. Princeton wanted a memo about my experiences of policy relevant observations, and
right.
And in part I turned it in as a protest, saying that the language of policy could not reach the experiences that I had had that summer. So I turned in this diary, and it caused kind of a stink. It's 400 pages.
Couldn't be contained in a memo either, right?
That's what I mean.
Right.
It didn't
yeah.
go in.
Right.
And well, anyway, one of the professors sent it off to this magazine that started publishing excerpts of it. So the first thing I ever had published, it never occurred to me to have a career as a writer or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I was still in graduate school at Princeton thinking between political activist and political theorist,
mm-hmm.
political philosophy. I loved philosophy. Even in high school when I was thinking of being an orthopedic surgeon, I had friends who had me read a lot of philosophy. So I didn't know what to... So this magazine started publishing, and when I finished my graduate degree, I still didn't know what I wanted to do, but I thought that maybe journalism would be a good halfway house between political activism and scholarship. Actually, what I had seen of political activism and scholarship made me like both of them less. But I didn't know, I had no other career ambition. So I went to this magazine that the Washington Monthly had published these excerpts from my journal that, you know, was the first thing I'd ever written that wasn't assigned by a teacher. And the
right.
first thing I ever got published, you know, I didn't submit to be published. So it was really an accidental entry into journalism. But I went there and worked in the magazine for several years at the height of the Vietnam War, the Pentagon Papers. Daniel Ellsberg brought us the Pentagon Papers before he took them to the New York Times. We didn't know what they were, and we didn't publish them. But this was a huge time of upheaval and the end of the Civil Rights era, the height of the Vietnam War, and all of this journalism. And I.
Do you remember some of the things that you wrote about? And did you start at the bottom there? And how did that
Well, it was a brand, it was a mom and pop magazine.
Okay, yeah.
Charlie Peters started it, and he had a temporary editor. I was the first full-time editor he hired. There were only three or four of us.
Okay.
We were putting out this magazine, and we did everything. We set the type, and we wrote a lot of the articles and edited other people's and commissioned them. And we even would walk on the way to work. We would go into drugstores and count how many Washington Monthlies there were, just so we could figure out whether it was selling or not. So
right.
it was a real
every single thing. Right.
It was a real mom and pop operation. It's still going, but it was exhausting, both because of we were so small and overworked, but also because of the tension of the political time. I divorced my first wife in the middle of all this. Lost my marriage. It was really very chaotic. Went on to
when had you gotten married?
I got married. I graduated from college on Thursday. Got married on Saturday. I think it was the day of Bobby Kennedy's funeral,
mm-hmm.
in June of '68. And then we went to Princeton and went to Washington at the end of Princeton to work at the Washington Monthly.
She didn't go with you in your Georgia.
No, she didn't. She taught at. She taught in Atlanta and stayed home, so
mm-hmm.
she didn't go on that. I think she regretted that, actually, and maybe it would have been good, but it was her parents probably would have shot me. It was because it was not considered a thing that it was
right.
not a normal thing to do.
Where did you stay when you were out there in the counties?
Usually, I stayed in a motel, but often if I had any hopes,
right.
With the three people. I stayed with them.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed in those houses because we could get more done.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of counties, nobody would
put
me
up. Right. Right.
So I had to stay in a motel and blow my whole $10 that I was getting for that day.
Right.
These very cheap motels. But out of all of that experience came two things. I mean, at the beginning of writing.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I wrote the diary was because I just had to. But the lesson that came out of there was I wrote the diary mostly because I was learning about race things by experiences that were not intellectual, that were really primal and very human. There were a lot of they were confounding me. I discovered a lot of folk wisdom, but it was not in the normal language and not in the normal way it was, which is why I wanted to write down the exact dialogue of what people were saying to me. And years later, as I wrote, you know, I stayed in journalism and I started writing books because I, after a while in magazines, I said, I don't think I am going to make up my mind what I'm going to do when I grow up. Writing is going to be a career, and I don't want to be writing magazine articles my whole life, so I want to try to write books as a way of doing this. I wrote several books and always asked my publisher if I could write about the civil rights movement, because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to answer the question, where did the power come from that changed my life's interest to want to do this? You know? So in a way, I was trying to answer a personal question. I wanted to answer where this thing come. I wasn't part of it. And after 10 or 15 years, I began to reason that that might not be a bad thing, that if I were a part of it, it would skew. You know, being an outsider is an advantage for observation and discovery. And that the time, it was 1982, I'd written several other books. I broke in as a ghostwriter, wrote John Dean's memoir of Watergate, and then Bill Russell's autobiography, The Basketball Player, and then I wrote a novel, and then I wrote a book about an international murder case, the murder of Orlando Letelier, Chilean ambassador blown up. So I did books, and I was always asking the publishers, you know, can I do King now? Can I do the movement now? And, finally, I talked to some of them, because I knew it was a big project. But the rule that I had, when I finally got a contract, because I wanted to do this, and finally got a contract to do it in 1982. Now, by then I had a two-year-old daughter and another one on the way, and a son on the way, was that it was going to be a storytelling, non-analytical history. And that was because of all those experiences I had that summer. Because the reason I really wanted to do it was because I read everything I could get my hands on about the civil rights movement, and everything I read was very argumentative and abstract, and it was massaging all these labels of militant and radical and this, that, and the other, and I found it all very unsatisfying. I really thought that it. The expression I use now is I thought it was all fool's gold. I mean, in the West, if you're Platonic, you're taught to believe that you make discoveries, that these the abstract ideas kind of command the details and that we reason down. But my experience in this summer was that I only really learned things about cross-culturally when I was nervous and fearful always. I learned things when things were human enough that I forgot all about my categories and the way you analyze things, and had this experience and that kind of reduced me or broke me down, and then I would reconstitute my outlook on all these things. In other words, I thought the human and the storytelling was the vehicle for discovery, and I knew enough about history as a history major to say that race, in particular, in American history, has a proven power when you're using analytical constructs to distort reality. The Civil War, Reconstruction. You know, I'd grown up studying the Redeemers, and what the Redeemers were the people, basically the terrorists that threw out the Reconstruction governments and redeemed white supremacy in the South. So if you're having religious terms of respect and even salvation applied to white terrorism to make people feel comfortable and obliterate the true history of Reconstruction, then once you start using labels around something like this across the color line, you can do anything and you can distort anything. And so I thought that the only antidote to that, and the only, and which it was conveniently for me, a sense of the path to the discovery I wanted to actually talk to people about where all this movement came from, was storytelling. Was to try to take everything down to the level of stories that were so human that it would resist the distortion by labeling.
Right.
So I And that's my proposal, says that. This is going to be a storytelling history, and that because of that, it's going to require a lot of interviews, it's going to require a lot of oral histories. I believe that cultures put in libraries what they're comfortable with, and that this is not in the library.
Mm-hmm.
And that therefore you've got to go out and do interviews. And this was 14 years after Dr. King died, and I felt that there was enough time had passed to have some historical perspective, but people were saying not enough, but if you waited too long, then the people you needed to talk to would be dead.
Right.
So it was a delicate thing, and I thought 14 years I'd already lost some people that were really important to interview, but like Stanley Levison was already dead, and I would dearly have loved to have interviewed him, but a lot of people weren't, so that's how I embarked on that, conceived as a storytelling narrative history out of my kind of out of my own experience. By then I had read Shelby Foote's 3-volume history of the Civil War, and it fortified my, because I hadn't been a Civil War buff at all. It was the first thing I ever read about the Civil War, but it was pretty captivating to me, and I don't care about, you know, military analysis and rolling up the left flank and all that, but it was engrossing as a narrative story.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying, here's a model for how you can do it.
Right. Was there? I mean, were you challenged at all by the notion of a project that would about Martin Luther King that you would tell through these other characters who, you know, are unknown? Was there any suspicion about that project, or was that something that you could...
What do you mean, suspicion?
Well, I mean, was that a difficult sell?
To the publisher?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, this is professional in the business and the culture. Race books don't sell. That's what they would say. Fat history books about race don't sell. So I certainly didn't say it was going to be more than one volume. I didn't know it was going to be more than one volume. I knew it was bigger than all my other books had taken, you know, a year.
Mm-hmm.
I think I did the Dean book in 9 months. The Russell book was maybe a year and a half, living in his basement. This proposal was for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
which was big, you know,
mm-hmm.
to get a publisher. I mean, I fuss about the publisher sometime, you know, and about publishing in general. But Simon & Schuster gave me a contract to spend 3 years, which is 3 times longer than anything else, on what was going to be a narrative history of the civil rights era. And it was written not as a biography of Dr. King. Bob Moses is in my, I knew in the proposal. I knew Diane Nash is in there.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that there were these other people, and that you could help tell a storytelling history about Dr. King only through these other people who
mm-hmm.
are to some degree fighting for his ear or doing their own things or not. I knew it was going to be big, but I had no idea it was going to take me 24 years and, you know, stretch into 3 books.
Did you have in that original proposal, did you have a number of people that you thought you would talk
interview?
To? Yeah.
No, I just said I'm going to have to do a heck of a lot of interviews, and then I'm also going to have to do a lot of archival research, because
right.
you got the presidential libraries, you got the FBI. The Kennedy Library, just as I turned in the proposal, released the first recording, revealed, because nobody even knew that presidents had taped there any meetings and phone calls. And the very first ones they released were the civil rights recordings. And so I knew that was going to, I had an inkling that that was going to be a lot of work. And,
right.
And it was more than I thought it was going to be. And because it takes forever, to this day, now this is, what, almost 30 years, 28 years later, most of the presidential conversations, you know, and after Kennedy, they discovered, you know, that Johnson taped,
sure,
and then they discovered that Nixon taped more than all the other presidents put together, and in recent years, we've discovered that Eisenhower did some tapes, and Truman, and even Roosevelt. But almost none of that has been transcribed. Michael Beschloss did some books transcribing a small fraction of the Johnson ones. Most of them hadn't even been transcribed yet. The ones that I did, I transcribed myself. I had to listen to them.
Really?
And that's a really hard thing to. So they haven't been transcribed, let alone put through the historical process to help understand, you know, how the presidents, in this case,
right.
were interacting with this, which to me is just an invaluable resource. So yeah, there was a lot of work. And in the proposal said, I'm going to do all the archival stuff, but I hope I discover a lot in there. But there's no substitute for interviews if you're
mm-hmm.
going to try to get behind the scenes and into the conflict. My theory, which was very quickly validated, was that most of the movement was about people in inner conflict and at one another's throats to some degree over what was going on. And that, in a way, is, how should I put it? I mean, in a way, it's obvious. It's an antidote to melodrama, which is
mm-hmm.
people not in conflict, the prayerful and serene black victim and the tobacco-spitting southern sheriff and all that. So melodrama, which is no good. But because people are in conflict, there was a natural tendency to hide the inner realities of what was going on, if for strategic reasons, if none other. If you're only 10% of the population in leading a black movement, and you're only a tiny fraction of that 10%
mm-hmm.
that are involved in the movement,
mm-hmm.
and that tiny fraction of the 10% is divided, but not only between Martin Luther King and SNCC and everything, but within SCLC and within SNCC,
sure.
then you're going to be, if you're sane, you're going to be reluctant to reveal those divisions because you already don't have any the normal tools of politics. So to get people to talk about what was really going on was not something they were accustomed to doing. Now,
mm-hmm.
I was coming on long enough afterwards that if they thought about it, which I prodded them to do, they wouldn't think that it was going to cause any harm
mm-hmm.
to reveal what was really going on, what were the dynamics within SNCC or inside the Freedom Rides or inside the things that were going. But my rule was, I want to keep going until I get a sense of what's really going on with them,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's J. Edgar Hoover or a sheriff or a sharecropper or Dr. King deciding what to do next.
What do you have any particular, particularly striking revelations that you came across? That, I mean, in just sort of thinking for a second about some of the many discoveries that I'm sure you made, are there some favorites that you have? Surprises, things that really surprised you?
Well. Well, I think the one that I got into earliest that there's so many.
Mm-hmm.
Just for openers, that his name wasn't Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, the family was very sensitive about that. And you still can't say for certain that Daddy King changed his name to Martin Luther. Explicitly to ape Martin Luther because he had just visited Martin Luther's gravesite.
Right.
But it makes a heck of a lot more sense than any alternative explanation because he had just, within the last couple of years, had a meteoric rise such that in the teeth of the Depression, his tiny little congregation sent him around the world. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is unbelievable for a black preacher in 1934. To be sent all over on this grand tour, and it was headlines in the Atlanta Daily World, Dr. King, Reverend King reaches Egypt,
wow.
the front page
yeah.
of the paper, and he comes
yeah.
back through Berlin and went to all these Lutheran sites and comes home and changes his name to Martin Luther
right.
instead of Michael Luther, and of course changed young
so
Mike's
so.
Name to, because he was junior.
Right.
And that embarrassed. Now, a lot of people did tell me that embarrassed. Dr. King assumed that's why he did it,
mm-hmm.
And it embarrassed him because it was his dad's big ego.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, I'm on par with the founder of Protestantism.
Right.
Vernon Johns, I loved Vernon Johns. It was a tremendous risk. In fact, my publisher, when I turned in the first chapter, said, you know, as I told you, race books don't sell. And all we've got going for us is that there's a latent public interest in Martin Luther King, and you're supposed to be make him the central character, and you turn in a first chapter that doesn't have Martin Luther King in it. It's about somebody nobody's ever heard of, this Vernon Johns creature. But to me, he was the answer to something that had paralyzed me, which was that all the research I had done, you couldn't start a book about the movement without some things that were had been foreign to me about the culture of the black church and how it worked and the deacons and the relations between deacons and preachers and different congregations and the congregational history and the association with the Hebrew scriptures rather than why is it that all black churches, virtually all of them, have names out of the Hebrew scriptures and where does that come from? That whole culture. And yet, that may be primary, but I've also got a rule that you can't write any essays, so it's got to be storytelling. And so I felt a need to write an essay about the black church colliding with my rule that you couldn't write any essays and you needed to have storytelling. And I didn't know how to start the whole book for months. I was really in crisis until I stumbled on this. I had a weird thing with Ralph Abernathy, and it grew out of an oral history thing. I was doing research all over doing first cut research, because I'd keep going back to do research when I was writing. But I was in Memphis, and this citizens group, after Dr. King was killed, put together an oral history project there. It's a very famous, within the movement. These are teachers and ministers, whites and blacks, who hadn't known each other. It was a big deal even that they would talk to one another, but they came together and said, this world-shaking event has happened here, we don't understand it, but let's try to collect material. And they went out and did oral histories. But one of the things that they did was that they went to the TV stations and gathered up their outtakes, their film. This is the Mississippi Valley Collection at Memphis State University. While I was paralyzed over how to start the book, I was there doing research, and I stayed in the Lorraine Motel, by the way, which was a flop house. They didn't even have keys. It's now this fabulous museum, but that's a real transformation from when I was there. I felt I wanted to sleep there, but you had to go knock on the door to get them to let you in your room because the hookers had stolen all the keys, and I'm staying there in the Lorraine Motel. But then I'd go through these oral histories and copy them, you know, this frantic daily research thing. And one of the things that I went through these TV outtakes, I just thought this was great. And they had one of Abernathy in the morgue on the night Dr. King was killed, and he was being interviewed by this young white reporter. And I identified with the young white reporter a lot because I had interviewed Abernathy. And he had been very frustrating, like a lot of them. Well, he'd give me, I was Martin's best friend and stuff, but it was all surface stuff. And I couldn't get anything to the really what was going on behind the scenes. But even my interviews, I didn't have as much trouble as this white reporter was, because Dr. Abernathy was basically in shock. He's in the morgue, and this white reporter is asking, you know, what did you see? Did you hear the shot? Where did you go? And Abernathy has just tuned him out. He's not saying anything. And the reporter got so frustrated, he finally said, well, can you at least tell me when you first met Dr. King? And it was like Abernathy came out of a trance. And he said, I first met my bosom friend Martin on a cold, wintry January morning when he arrived at my parsonage in the company of our common mentor, Vernon Johns. And he started, and I called my wife and I said, Vernon Johns is here. Juanita, fix the prophet's dinner. And he started telling Vernon Johns stories, how he had sold lingerie for him and everything. and how funny he was, and how learned he was, and how brilliant he was, and how he had gotten run out of Dexter Avenue, Dr. King. And I knew that Vernon Johns, just from my scholarly research, that he had been King's predecessor. Mm-hmm. But that's basically all I knew about him. And Abernathy started telling all these Vernon Johns stories that were humorous, that were profound. He clearly looked up to him, and he said King did too, and he gave him advice about it. And also, Johns told King not to go to that Dexter Avenue church because it was a den of vipers, that all the deacons were high-minded and this, that, and the other. And so this was very rich material, but what really interested me was that Vernon Johns meant so much to Ralph Abernathy that it seemed to bring him out of the shock of the mm-hmm. King, and he told all these stories to the point that the reporter, who hadn't been able to get Abernathy to say anything, got frustrated that he couldn't get him to shut up. He kept saying, but Dr. Abernathy, the Chicago is there are riots in Chicago, and Washington is reportedly in flames, and Abernathy was oblivious again. He's telling Vernon John's story. So to me, that means this guy might be important enough, important on his own right, but he also might be a way of getting Abernathy to open up. So the next time I went to Abernathy, I had all this, as much Vernon Johns stuff as I could, and I started asking him about Vernon Johns, and it was like putting the motor in a key in an engine that wouldn't start. He started talking about it, and so did virtually every other preacher that I interviewed. And so the Vernon Johns material, which none of which was in the library, none. That whole chapter is written out of, you know, folk wisdom and interviews and very, very common and, to my mind, historiographically convincing, because there was so much reinforcement. There were so many common stories. There was so much. It was all in the realm of oral history, but it seemed really strong to me. And so I wrote the first chapter. I thought you could tell the story of Vernon Johns in a storytelling way and get across the background not only of the black church, but of the very milieu in which King and even some of the divisions between his church and Abernathy's church that would be pertinent to the Freedom Rides and stuff that was going on in Montgomery.
And this kind of prophetic character.
So anyway, it was... But that was because of the storytelling rule.
Right. I gotta swap out the tape.
So is this about more than you wanted?
This is fantastic. Do you have more time, or do you want to? It's 20 after 5.
Yeah. What? Well, I think we're okay.
Okay. Let me just grab this tape. So this is April 17th, 2010, with David Klein with Taylor Branch, tape number 2. And so we were just talking about how you found a beginning, I guess, for that story. Yeah.
For what became Parting the Waters. I knew was it was the beginning of the King story, kind of before the bus boycott, really even before King was introduced. That chapter ends with Vernon Johns asking Martin Luther King to take him to Montgomery, basically the story that Abernathy told in the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. I mean, we had to cut an awful lot. I was enthralled with the material. I did do what the proposal said, meaning do lots of archival research. I started with Winthrop Jordan's White Over Black, reading books, you know, because I didn't have that much background in it. I read constantly, and then was going to the presidential libraries, and the King Library, by the way, also opened in 1982, the same year that my proposal was. So there was a lot of material there, although doing research there was always an adventure.
Were the materials and had they been processed? Were they any?
Been processed, but. I don't think I want to get in it's another whole subject, but
right.
The King family was ambivalent, to put it mildly, about whether they really wanted all this material open. I don't know that they knew what all was in there.
Right.
And several times I would be there doing research, and some lawyer would show up, and they would close the whole thing and throw people out. But there was a lot of really good material there. I'm not saying it was just required a lot of persistence. And the FBI reading room was even worse, because they had it in a windowless room in the basement, and you couldn't even go to the. They had all this ridiculous security, onerous security. You couldn't go to the bathroom when you're in there without being escorted. And I think this was deliberate. You had to get escorted back outside the security perimeter and then go back through clearance. So to go to the bathroom took an hour,
right?
Just to go pee. And so to me that was precious, because if you're going through, I had to go through hundreds of thousands of pages of FBI, and you're just looking, thumbing through, looking, scanning for, first of all, for a document with substance, and second of all, if the substance might become pertinent. And if it was, then you had to mark it and get them to copy it. And that was onerous too. You had to write out the document so they could identify it, put a paperclip in it. Well, this is bleary-eyed work.
Oh, okay.
And so if you have to stop and go to the bathroom, you may have to do it other day. So I finally decided that FBI days were a no coffee day, that in the morning I could not drink any coffee, because, you know, so that I would go through the whole day, and these guys, these clerks there would be amazed that I would go in at 8 o'clock and leave at 4 o'clock.
Right.
So the research was an adventure. Reading the books was an adventure. But
was the extent of the wiretapping known when you began your research?
Yes, but what I didn't know was what the was which wiretap logs would be most useful. A lot of them, they do these summaries, and they only listen for the things that they think are pertinent.
Sure, right.
And then they have the memos that are written off the basis of the raw logs, and the raw logs are very voluminous, and for King, they discarded a lot of them. The real mother lode, the gold mine, was that they didn't destroy the raw, as close to as they have to verbatim transcripts of the Stanley Levison files, not the Martin Luther King files. What they kept in the Martin Luther King files were the memos that they wrote to Hoover, that Hoover would then distribute politically. And as a rule, I came to discover that the logs, the raw logs, were pretty close, because I would take a raw log to Bayard Rustin of King talking to Bayard and say, "Bayard, this is, look at this." And he'd say, "That looks pretty, you know, we talked that way, that was our language," and stuff like that. But the higher up it went, everybody in the FBI was basically interested in telling Hoover what he wanted to hear. So they would, the higher up it went, the more they got slanted. So those, to some degree the Rustin ones, but particularly the Stanley Levison raw files were the most. They were voluminous, but they were really useful. The Martin Luther King wiretap files are mostly the political memos, and they're interesting, but to me, historically, they're more interesting about the FBI's state of mind, which was to put the most negative. If Stanley Levison tells Martin Luther King that Negroes have no institutions of power from which to mount a movement, in the Martin Luther King file, that might be a memo to Hoover saying, Stanley Levison says Negroes may want to overthrow the government because they have no. So it would have some sort of hostile interpretation on it, and a lot of times was not accurate. So, I mean, that would be interesting for if I were wanted to make a point about the FBI, but usually I wasn't trying to do that. You know?
Right.
Anyway, it's a whole education just to get in there in the FBI world. That was, the FBI was a large part of the presidential library system. I found the Kennedy Library. I mean, just matters of the Kennedy Library was the most frustrating because they had all these restrictions in addition to classification restrictions. Classification is always a bane and, mm-hmm. and a terror because, you know, I didn't really believe there was anything in there that would really affect the national security. But they had a lot of national security materials blanked out, which always mm-hmm. upsets a historian. But they also had material blanked out that said restricted on guidance of donors' representative, which was a euphemistic kind of liberal's way of saying, we think it might embarrass the Kennedy family, so we're not going to let you see this. The Johnson Library, the Eisenhower Library was pretty good. The Johnson Library is great. It's a researcher's dream. They come dig in my bones. Yes, Lyndon was a wild character, and nothing you find about Lyndon's going to embarrass us.
Right.
So they were really nice people. I wish the King Library were more like that.
When I was down in Southwest Georgia this summer for sort of a mini reunion of some folks who had worked down there, and many of them talked about, well, there were many sort of local people that they remembered and that we reconnected with that weekend, but a lot of this one woman's name kept coming up was this woman, Mama Dolly, that they had, who had put up many civil rights
in Terrell
workers.
County?
Yeah.
In Dawson?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just curious if there were sort of characters like this that you ran across in other places that were, you know, clearly not famous civil rights figures, but were sort of local movement characters that you got interested in or seemed to begin to play a bigger role in these kind of stories for you. As someone who's, you know, very story-driven.
Well, I got fascinated by a lot of people. And
yeah.
Many of them were not, some of them didn't survive, like Vernon Dahmer. Clyde Kinnard. I mean, these are people, the first guy that tried to go to Mississippi and they put him in prison. But he had a big impact. The reason that those stories became important was because they were mentors like Medgar Evers for some of the people who became big activists in the movement. Lawrence Guyot, the Ladners. When they were telling the stories of the people that motivated them that had been their mentors, they would tell me stories about people like Dahmer and Kennard that I'd never really heard of. Then you got to try to figure out, can you incorporate that into a narrative?
Right.
Is that going to work as a narrative? Same thing happened in a whole different arena in the second volume when I'm doing a lot of work on Malcolm X, because then I've got to go try to find people from within his world, and that world is a very, very hidden, recondite world that's been turned inside out many times. It was conspiratorial. Some of the people stayed with Farrakhan and kind of stayed in a separate reality. Other people came out with Wallace Muhammad, and there were grudge matches, and I don't know. It's kind of like the Godfather in the Old Testament, all rolled into one. So that was a real challenge. There were a lot of legendary characters in there. Benjamin Kareem, Captain Joseph, who was like the head of the soldiers in Mosque Number 7. Getting to talk to Captain Joseph about what was really going on. By the end of this, I really came to the belief that the last year and a half of Malcolm's life is pretty much of a blank. I did what I could to it, but the drama of him when he's leaving, he's fleeing the country, he's gone a lot, he's in conflict with Elijah Muhammad, he's trying to make an alliance with Elijah's son, who died not long ago, and I think is the most, one of the most impressive people that I interviewed in the whole thing. Basically, Wallace and Malcolm agreed on everything except Wallace said that Malcolm was impatient, but they agreed on everything else. But you know, you get into different fields. I had to learn stuff about Judaism to do Abraham Heschel and Heschel's relationship with King, and I didn't know very much about that at all. And you know, everything tends to hurtle backwards. You know, trying to do Malcolm X, after a while, people start saying, have you ever read the Quran? What do you know about the history of Islam?
Right.
And you realize that if these people are really struggling overtly and consciously, they say, to implant Islam solidly on American soil and to have African Americans become like the welcoming board or like the acculturators of Islam to immigrants coming from all over the world, that you can't expect to go in there and say, I don't know anything about Islam. I have to read the Quran at least enough to be able to say, my gosh, I was really surprised by how many stories in there were familiar. That they have Noah, and they have all these things. They have Jesus. They have, but then they have all this other language. Well, what translation did you read? And, what are you
interested? So, did you have to do that? I assume you have to do the same for understanding the sort of Old Testament and prophet influence for these preachers.
And then find it, right, and then to find out from everybody I talked to around King carried around Heschel's The Prophet, which is a wonderful book. I mean, particularly, it's now in paperback. The first volume of Heschel's two-volume The Prophets is just a fabulous, fabulous book. And so, so then you have to interview those. So,
right.
But it's like a big house with a lot of surprise rooms and a varying mix of rich intellectual or historical underpinnings and these characters.
Right. So, by way of wrapping up, and since we are at the SNCC 50th anniversary conference, I'm wondering if there is sort of a particular unwritten story about SNCC that you can think of, or something that, you know, I don't know, something that struck you this weekend or that you've been thinking of that hasn't been told about the SNCC story particularly, or that you think is missing from the...
Well, there's a lot missing. You know, I think, to me, the shocking gap, and this, I said this to some degree in my presentation, because I was trying to talk about the historiography of this, that I think our national politics still suffers from a shocking gap between the actual reality of what the SNCC people and the larger civil rights movement actually put into motion, which was so good and so broad. You know, we wouldn't be debating gay marriage in the United States if SNCC hadn't shoved into motion such a profound discussion about what equal rights means and equal citizenship means. And the same thing with women and the disabled and the elderly and all those other things that came out of there. But that's not part of the consciousness of most people. In other words, that women students go to West Point, which was a joke. Anybody would have laughed at you if you said girls are going to go to West Point at the time of the movement. But now we don't think anything about it. But we certainly don't think that it's... we don't associate that with the legacy of this movement.
Right.
And white Southerners don't associate the Sun Belt and the prosperity and the Major League football and baseball teams that were impossible in segregation. These blessings as things, or the two-party political structure, which was unfeasible under white supremacy. You had an atrophied one-party Democratic South, so that you could enforce white supremacy and not allow the black vote to become a swing vote. Now we have two, for better or worse, we have two-party competition. The Republicans, by and large, have replaced the old presumptive party of white people, and the Democrats are new.
Right.
They're trying out and not doing so well, but that's new. It's a new, but regardless of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, I think most people who think at all about civics would say it's a better off to be a two-party competitive system, however it works. And the economy is certainly better. We're not the hookworm belt anymore. We're the Sun Belt.
Right.
All of these are consequences of the movement, and the movement doesn't get credit for it. But more, there are two layers of it beyond that, beyond the empirical. It's the attitude, our attitude toward politics, if they did get credit, or if we had a a more integrated and historically accurate attitude toward politics. For all the upheaval of the 1960s, it should have engendered political optimism and more people wanting to go into public service and more people saying, we accomplished miracles,
mm-hmm.
Attacking really intractable problems that had paralyzed the country for a long time. And therefore, this is really great. We should, and the people that sparked this or were the catalyst for this were people who studied democratic theory very deeply, took religion very seriously, violence very seriously, were perpetually trying to think about things and took citizenship and democracy as a very profound challenge that belonged to them. And that we should be doing that too, and that we could tackle,
mm-hmm.
you know, our problems today. Instead, I think because we don't appreciate the legacy that these people did, we've allowed our culture to say instead that politics is inherently malevolent or dangerous. The dominant idea is that politics is bad, that government is most likely a threat rather than an arbiter for these for political advancement. And so we're really our politics is crippled, and the people in the movement, I think, to some degree are rightly, or they are understandably hungry for credit, which is why you see here a lot of talk about who's the most unsung hero, just calling out names and all that sort
mm-hmm.
of thing. And there's not, and I have complained this weekend openly to them saying you need to get more historical perspective on this, in part to lay claim to the things that you did. They're maybe
mm-hmm.
reluctant to lay claim to the benefit, say, to women, or
mm-hmm.
I think that they could lay claim to Nelson Mandela and the fall of the Berlin Wall, that nonviolence
mm-hmm.
really has gone around the world, or even
mm-hmm.
Tiananmen Square,
mm-hmm.
That this is a wonderful thing, that they could lay claim to it. But in some respects, they're reluctant to lay claim to it, I think, because it is so broad and it benefits non-black people that it would dilute the remaining struggle for black people,
mm-hmm.
or dilute the racial character of it. Certainly it started out racially, but my argument is even if you want to draw attention to the racial achievements or to the racial non-achievements, the things that are still there, it's in your interest to point out to people this was a very powerful thing that brought blessings to the world and ought to or should have gotten people to take politics more seriously the way they took it.
Mm-hmm.
But my interpretation as to the reason that they don't is that because one of the very first things that the country did to digest this revolution that came from people that had been invisible and that weren't really up close and personal, and they weren't friends of Walter Cronkite and all that, you know, it was a foreign thing, was that they were never recognized for, it was utterly foreign for people to treat them what they really were. They were really, my word for them is modern founders. They were
mm-hmm.
doing just what the founding fathers did. Mm-hmm. They were the political leaders of that period in the sense that they were confronting hierarchy and subjugation and figuring out ways to set in motion equal
mm-hmm.
citizenship. That's just what Washington and Jefferson and Madison and all of them did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody that I know of treats these black folks
mm-hmm.
from colleges as modern founding fathers. But if we did, then we could bring ourselves to give them that kind of credit and to essentially humble the majority culture to treat them as a model. It would give them their due, but more importantly, it would become easier then to take seriously the kind of, they were right at the bottom of democratic theory and religious theory
mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
and where they come together and nonviolence and all these things that we don't debate now, and we don't debate them at our peril. So I think that's been my this week at the 50th anniversary, I've been trying to tell these people, it may be hard for you to get more historical perspective in order to lay claim to the broad benefits that you let loose. You may lose a little of your racial agenda, but not only would it be good for you and your racial agenda, but it would be good for the country. If the country understood the benefits, we wouldn't be so cynical about politics. Part of our cynicism is because the country has been too fearful or too resentful to appreciate the legacy of the civil rights movement.
Wonderful. I think we can
end
there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your time. It's fantastic.
So this will go to